Warrior
at the same time that he is pursuing the appeal?
Your Honor, I think to answer any other way than what I am would be to be being intellectually dishonest with this court. If a lawyer, and let's assume got a case like the one preceding this, the Doodle case, if the lawyer tells the client, the statute of limitations makes no difference, let's file this lawsuit, we can win. It occurs to me, or I would admit, that every time that lawyer makes such a representation, it's a new claim.
He says, I screwed up, but I think we can correct it on appeal. And he represents the client on appeal. That puts the client in a position where he has to sue the attorney before the appeal is resolved.
Well, if we stay with the actual deposition of where an illegal injury occurs, you're exactly right. He would have to do that. Are we to then say that all the prospective plaintiffs in this case have to be less smart or less cognizant of what they should do based on what the law has been?
Well, then that also places the client in the position of asserting what viewpoint is the appellate action and filing a lawsuit that takes exactly the contrary position to that being asserted on the appeal, all at the same time?
Well, I will agree that that could happen. In the case that we're talking about today, the facts of the business is that if my client, Mr. Mahaney, and his partner did anything wrong, it was their omission of doing something prior to the revocation of the affidavit of relinquishment. That revocation that's in the record occurred on February the 17th of 1983. The plaintiff's or petitioner's rights, insofar as his omission is concerned, if they have any, were fixed in time at that point. No matter what happens afterwards, if that's the basis of their allegations against my client, and therefore that they're fixed right then. Then nothing's going to change that, because that's when a legal injury occurred. In this case, yes, sir.
But even after that, the trial court went through, terminated the parental rights, granted the adoption, and only after the appellate process was concluded that these people had to give up their child. You say they should have known, they should have just given up at that point, given the child back to sue the lawyer, and she revoked her relationship.
Well, I don't know if I'm saying anything, at least
that's
simply, but... Well, let's look at what the
and
facts...
They suffered our injury, let's give up the child and sue our lawyer. Let's not fight this thing. Let's not pursue it through the court. Let's not even go to the trial court and see if the trial court will grant the adoption. The trial court did it. And it was years later.
Well, the same. Excuse me. I'm sorry.
The final legal determination that determines they have been legally injured.
The same thing would have occurred as has had occurred here, if they're right about their underlying claim against my client. I mean, even if they bring a malpractice suit, it's still a suit, a trial within a trial. So that's all going to come out. Here, we had the February 17th, 83 date, which the proof conclusively shows they knew that the affidavit had been revoked and nothing had been done. My client, Mr. Mahaney, was, by order of the court, dismissed from representing the petitioners on August the 8th of 1983. On July 15th of 1983, the original motion to dismiss the lawsuit based on these lack of standing was filed. So we're talking about a series of times in this whole time frame where these plaintiffs had knowledge or should have had knowledge that perhaps something was amiss. And in addition to that, they testified in deposition that they even talked to. I disagree with that. I disagree with that because the basis of their petition is an omission by my client that he did not do something within the time that affidavit was either irrevocable or unrevoked.
Counsel, how do you reconcile your position with the Atkins v. Crossland case?
In Atkins v. Crossland, Your Honor, an accountant was using one of two tax methods to prepare his client's income tax return, the accrual method and the cash method. and forgive me, but I don't remember which was the one that cost more tax, but I believe that he used the cash method, and he could have used the accrual method. Well, at some point, the IRS assessed the taxpayer, the lawyer's client, and said, hey, you owe us $12,000. And the taxpayer said, well, yeah, but I could have done this or I could have done that. But my accountant didn't do it. So, and the Atkins court did not relate that back to the time the accountant actually elected to use the cash or the accrual method, whichever one it was. They said his limitation
period... on which you say the legal injury would have occurred.
No, sir, I don't say that in Atkins versus Crossman. I believe it's easily distinguishable.
Okay.
Because here, you don't have an actual invasion. You've got a guy electing to use a method of accounting, cash or accrual. He doesn't have any reason to think that's wrong. There's nothing inherently wrong about electing to use one of two methods. The part that makes it wrong is when the IRS, now the IRS is not a court. The IRS is just a third party out there that can tell you to do something, albeit a real big third party that you don't argue with a whole lot. But I think a major distinction in Atkins versus Crossland is nobody ever appealed, the taxpayer never appealed in Atkins versus Crossland. Consequently, there was the first thrust, or there's where the damages could have started right when that happened. Now, the taxpayer at that time could have gone through the administrative level. If he didn't like what he got through the administrative level, he could have gone into the tax court. This was never done. So nobody really knows. They're just saying that's the first time that taxpayer's rights, or that a right he had was invaded, and that's what started it.
Counsel, you think we ought to have the same rule, the same statute of limitations as it applies to accountants, physicians, and lawyers, or is there any reason to have any difference between the treatment of statute of limitations in any case against any of those three types of parties?
I think it is the same. I don't think we've got really a diversity or how we treat them. In the case of Atkins versus Crossland, the accountant actually done something that invaded the guy's right at that time, like told him, we'll do this, we'll hide this income. Well, I think clearly that would have been found in an Atkins versus Crossman situation, as that's the time the legal injury occurred, because the guy was relying on what the accountant told him.
So let me give you one more hypothetical.
Okay.
That is, a patient goes to a doctor, and the doctor completes treatment. A week later, concerned, the patient goes to another doctor. Second doctor says, well, your earlier treatment should have included this, and it was negligent and below the standard of care not to, but it may not ever result in any problems for you. We'll just have to see. 5 years later, it does. When does the cause of action accrue?
I guess the question that I've got to address is, when did that patient actually discover what was there?
A week after, well, he discovered that it might have been negligent a week after his treatment from the first physician ended.
This may be a matter of arguing semantics, but if a person is told this might be a problem and they rely on that representation of them, then they are charged, I would think, with knowledge at that time. Now, later on, I mean, the cases as far as legal injury have always said once the invasion was there. Consequently, the invasion occurred when the preceding doctor failed to treat or failed to diagnose or whatever he or she did. If it takes a long time for the damages to be ascertained, then there are cases that say even if up until the time of trial the damages have not been completely suffered, that a jury can still be asked to ascertain what damages there will be if this is an ongoing problem. And, of course, that happens in most of your injury cases. Nobody, it seems, ever gets cured completely anymore.
But if he brings the cause of action immediately and tells the jury, this was negligent, we have an expert here who will testify that this was below the standard of care, but I may not ever suffer for it, he's not likely to recover much damage.
If he brings the lawsuit that fast, that's probably right.
Counsel, if the petitioners here had chosen not to pursue any appeal after the Waco court wrote and to this court, but had just decided at that time we've had enough, we're going to sue our lawyer then, would they have had a viable or at least as viable as they claim to have now, cause of action?
Well, it kind of puts me on the spot. I'm going to have to, I'll tell you that there's a way. My position in this case is that once a legal injury is suffered, it's suffered, and that starts the limitations.
Counsel, let me give the other side of this court's question then in that regard.
If you could finish answering my question, I'd appreciate it.
Okay.
First. And then
don't do it. If they actually know about it and the evidence points up that they did know that this omission had occurred at that time, that starts the limitations. My position is that by all means, by the time March the 7th came around in the Waco Court of Appeals, their decision, that they could have had full knowledge no later than that date, given the fact that that was a major concern in September of 1983 when the hearing was had on the first motion to dismiss. You accumulate it all, and I think there is no way that a person, a reasonably prudent person, could not have known that there was a problem or had reason to look in. Yes, sir.
If the biological parents had not appealed the trial court's judgment in this case, the underlying adoption case, what legal injury, what damages would have been used and suffered? If they allowed the trial court's judgment to become final, they had not appealed the way they
Well, they would have suffered the damages that flow from the fact that the termination and adoption was not done quickly.
The termination and adoption was done by the trial court, only on appeal. No, wait.
Court
first. If the biological parents did not appeal the adoption granted in the trial court, what legal injury, what damages would be used for suffering?
Okay.
You say that their cause of action had arisen back when the biological mother was
over to relate. Right. Let me go.
What cause of action was
it? Well, had... If Mr. Mahaney did anything wrong, according to the plaintiff's petition, it occurred sometime before the affidavit of relinquishment was revoked. In other words, during that time, Mr. Mahaney could have done other things other than what he did, I guess. If he would have done something prior to that, the affidavit would have expired. Its 60-day irrevocable period expired on February the 6th, 1983. Anything done before that, he would have gone to court, you know, assuming that he could have got there. The baby would have been adopted. They would have never had all the attorney's fees, time, trial, and effort that went into actually trying the lawsuit that was presented to the Court of Appeals in 85. All those damages they incurred as a result of having something not done during that irrevocable period of that affidavit. Well, they say... Judge, if we're just, you know, just focusing on the loss of a child, and I realize this is, you know, not a good issue. Sure. But I think that when we're talking about it, what damages flowed from that? And if you look at a legal injury, they were actually damaged if, in fact, what they allege is true. Because that adoption did not take place at that time. As soon as that occurred, and that was the contract that has allegedly been made, that this would get done in a... proper manner, then as soon as that wasn't done, the invasion occurs. They did lose that child at that point. Well, let's look at it this way. They lost the child as soon as nothing was done during that period that affidavit was irrevocable, because then started the whole process that culminated by the NRE decision by this court.
They might have argued during the period of years after that they had possession of that child.
I'm sure they had possession. But the legal right to the child, I believe, is what we're addressing.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court.
in trying to distinguish the Atkins case and saying that the negligence of the accountant in choosing the accrual versus the cash or the cash versus the accrual, I'm like Bob, I don't remember which is which, that in and of itself was not an invasion of the rights of the plaintiff in Atkins, is engaging in a very reaching attempt to distinguish negligence from negligence. Simple fact in Atkins is the accountant was negligent in what he did.
Under your theory, if the accountant had chosen to appeal the case through the administrative process, as counsel said, to the tax court, plaintiff could in effect determine the date of legal injury depending on what they chose or chose not to do in terms of pursuing their legal rights, couldn't they?
That fits exactly with what I've been saying to the court, that the legal injury attaches.
No, I know you've been saying that it depends on the acts of the petitioner in this case. The date of legal injury depends on whether they chose to appeal to the next level or chose to contest the issue in a court. Does that make good sense, that a party to the dispute ought to be able to determine the date of legal injury based upon what they do or choose not to do?
Well, my point as far as I think maybe we have miscommunicated on what I'm saying legal injury date is. The legal injury date in this context is the date upon which the judgment becomes final and subject to execution. The legal injury date in the Atkins context attaches once that tax liability becomes final. And once that's assessed, there are certain dates that you either do or do not.
If your clients had chosen not to appeal the Waco Court of Appeals decision, when that judgment became final, their legal injury would have accrued.
Would have accrued.
But since they chose to appeal to the Supreme Court, the legal injury date was later in time because it depends, under your analysis, on when this court's judgment becomes final, correct?
Correct. And otherwise would be to take someone in the Hughes' position and penalize them for continuing to try to win. You would put them in the position of saying, an appeal to this court, if I've been adversely ruled upon in the Court of Appeals, an appeal to this court is futile.
And if they had applied for writ of certiorari to the United States Supreme Court under some arguable theory, the date of legal injury would be postponed until that was denied, correct?
Correct. At the point that the judgment becomes subject to execution, or whatever point that is when that attaches, which is the doctrine in which we have analogized this case to, espoused under Stowers, which is, and the negligence in a Stowers case occurs way before the adverse judgment.
What is your response to my medical hypothetical?
To your what?
Medical hypothetical.
Well, there's one distinction I would have, but without talking with respect to the statute, it seems to have changed certain aspects. My response would be simply the mere fact that the negligent conduct occurred, if it did not ever cause a harm, a tort never completed, and there was no cause of action until the harm occurred.
Counsel, the Ninth Circuit has held with respect to a lawyer giving advice to a client on a tax shelter, which is later determined by the IRS to be fraudulent, that the injury occurs on the date of the advice and not on the date of disallowance by the IRS. Would that not cause a contrary to result to what you're arguing today?
That is contrary to what I'm saying, that the legal injury does not attach until some harm has been suffered by the injured individual.
There's a great deal of conflict, is there not, and a lot of variations of what we're talking about.
Yes, there is. And I feel like our case is a good example of the unreasonableness, the engaging in the fiction of legal injury occurs when you've exposed them to some potential risk because of negligence. Because in this case, as Mr. Aldrich has pointed out to you, the negligent actions of the defendants in this case occurred in February of 1982, or December of 1982. And according to them, that's when our rights were invaded and our statute began to run. And the Hughes, he says, were aware. And therefore, they should have filed their action against Mr. Mahaney and the other defendants by 1984, at a point in time when no appellate court had overruled them, that they had been declared the winner in the trial court, yet they were supposed to have already sued, saying, we're going to lose.
Any other questions?
the argument. Both topics in today. These topics are submitted on brief and oral arguments from the Marshall will now come to the floor.
Oyez, oyez.